thank you all for coming again to the second week of Ezekiel. Hopefully you guys picked up some notes in the back and everything. And probably, in all honesty, we're probably only going to get through chapter one today. So we might not even make it to the new handout that I put out there. So if you don't have it right now, then that's okay. We might not even use it. So. But hopefully you guys brought back notes from last week and everything. If you didn't have some, there's some extras back there from last week. And we'll be just diving into chapter one and finishing that, Lord willing, today. So let me open this up in prayer, and then we'll get right into it. Dear Lord, I just thank you for another day that we can live to study your word, to take a look at what you have revealed in your scriptures, Lord, and what you have written in a book that is often neglected, Lord, but is a book that displays you so gloriously. It should not be neglected, Lord. And as we look today at a passage that really does exclaim all about your glory, humble us before it, and just grant us understanding and as we approach some things that can be more difficult. Pray you grant me grace as I seek to explain this text. You keep me from error and just guard my words, Lord. I pray that study of this chapter will increase our view of you, Lord, that we would see you higher and more exalted as you should be, Lord, and that it increase our love for you, Lord. Just thank you for this time. Pray that you be with this time. Pray these things in your son's name. Amen. All right, so this week we'll actually get into the book itself. For those of you who are looking forward to that, last week was all introduction, which was stuff that was necessary, though. Hopefully you guys kind of realize that it is necessary as we trace through just the presence of God throughout, which is, for those of you who weren't here, Ezekiel, the whole book, the presence of God is the theme of the entire book, all about God's presence, God's relationship with mankind. And so last week we kind of traced through parts of the Bible, looking at the Garden of Eden, Israel, the temple, all those things, tracing through the presence of God and how that related to man, and just setting up, kind of setting up for Ezekiel and where we're coming in, because we can't just jump into the book of Ezekiel without looking at what has happened before, or else that's where a lot of confusion takes place. And so, but now that we have looked at all that introductory matter and all the things, we can actually get into the text itself. And so, starting, I don't know what page it is, I didn't number the pages, but the vision of God, chapter 1, verses 1 to 28. So the setting, the first three verses, kind of, they give the setting of what's going on in the book of Ezekiel. And we should realize, first off, there's a two-part structure to this introduction. The first part is verse 1, and the second part is verses 2 and 3. Verse 1 is the personal introduction, the personal introduction to the book, Ezekiel's personal introduction. And then verses 2 and 3 are the historical or official introduction, like the historical introduction. In most cases, if you look at the other prophetic books, like Isaiah or Jeremiah or some of the smaller prophetic books, you'll see that they have an intro that's very similar to verses 2 and 3. That idea of they give the time. So on this, in verse 2, it says, on the fifth day of the month is the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin. So they give like a date and the king that's reigning at the time, and then the word of the Lord came to them. That's kind of the similar formula seen throughout a lot of the prophets. But Ezekiel doesn't start with that. He starts with a personal aspect to it. And so the question is, why have two introductions? Why use two? Why couldn't he just use the normal historical one? The first reason why we have the personal introduction is because that it shows right off the bat that the way God interacts with Ezekiel is going to show and communicate God's plan for the nation of Israel. So what the interactions that God has with Ezekiel, the words he speaks through Ezekiel, and how he relates with Ezekiel is going to communicate God's plan for the nation of Israel. So it's not that Ezekiel's selfish and he's like, look at me, look what I want, and stuff, as some might suggest. No, it's the fact that he's recognizing right away that my experiences, what is going to happen to me in these coming chapters in this book, is going to be representative of what's going to happen with Israel, and namely the world through that. And then, okay, well then why not just have that? Why not just have the personal introduction? Second reason then would be the historical introduction serves to show and insert Ezekiel into the big picture of redemptive history. The historical introduction shows that God's program is still moving. It's still going on. It connects Ezekiel to the larger picture. That's essentially the purpose of the second introduction, the historical one, to show that this is part of the bigger story that's going on. And so we have that two-part structure. So we'll get into the text now itself. It says in verse 1, in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the exiles by the Kibar Canal, the heavens were open, and I saw visions of God. And so we start out with the mention of a 30th year. And then if you notice in verse 2, he gives another year, the fifth year of the exile. So the question right off the bat is, okay, what is this 30th year referring to? Because most of the time when the prophets give the date, it's the date in history, and usually they relate it to the king, like in the fifth year of this guy's reign and all that, which verse 2 does. So then what is verse 1 doing? The 30th year, probably the most likely explanation is that it's Ezekiel's birthday, actually. That part of the personal introduction, it is his birthday. Some argue that the 30th year is actually part of the exile, the 30th year of the exile, but that just does not match up with verse 2 and does not match up with the date of the exiles themselves. And so that doesn't make sense. So the most likely answer to that is it's his birthday. And why? Why would he even mention this? Because if you look back in Numbers, if you look back in Numbers 4, verse 3, we see that at the age of 30, that's when priests and those who serve in the temple can actually start to serve. That they actually start their duties at the age of 30. And we see in verse 3 that Ezekiel himself is a priest. And so essentially, he's recognizing this is the 30th year, this is when I should have became a priest. But for those of you who were here last week or read this, what's the problem with that? He's not in Israel, right? He's nowhere near the temple. So not only is he bummed because he's exiled on his birthday, right? That would just be depressing as it is. But even more so than that, it's a huge birthday because 30 years he's been training to be a priest all his life, and then now when he finally can be a priest, he's nowhere near the temple, nowhere near as he feels the presence of God. And that's emphasized when it continues, as I was among the exiles of the Kibar, by the Kibar Canal. So he was among the exiles, those who Babylon had taken away from out of the land of Israel to Babylon. And so, kind of, I don't know, give a little map. That's Israel. So Babylon would be like up here. That's not the scale. So you'd have like Babylon itself, the capital of Babylon, or Babylon, I forget which one. But then you'd have kind of marked it out. I think it says in this that it's near Tel Aviv, or that's somewhere later. Not sure. But you'd be somewhere down here, southeast of Babylon. And so, as you can see, it's pretty far, right? Jerusalem, temple, somewhere around there. And we talked about last time that the second wave of the exile, right? The whole goal was isolation, to isolate the people they had captured far from their territory, far from their country, to make it seem like all hope is lost, that your God can't save you now. Because the thought back then was your God was associated with a certain land, a certain place. And so that whole tactic was to show that our God is stronger, our God has done this, they've conquered you, and now your God can't even help you because he's miles away. And so Ezekiel's feeling this. Ezekiel is feeling this pressure, right? Because he is far. He's like, okay, I'm supposed to be a priest, but there's just no way. I'm thousands of miles away. It's not even, and I'm trapped in pretty much the stronghold of the Babylonian God. And we'll see that the truth behind that as we get into the later verses. But then, when it seems like all hope is lost, we see the next phrase, the heavens were opened. In verse 1, the heavens were opened. As most of you probably know, that's not a normal event. Even in the Bible, we might think, oh, that's normal for the Bible, but no, not really. It happens less than 10 times. And each time is very significant. First time, essentially, is in the flood, and you can trace the different times, but basically the big picture, what that entails, and we can go into a lot more detail, but we won't, is that the opening of heavens essentially mark a decisive intervention by God, that this shows that God is about to intervene in some way, in some direct way. And so, like, when it's first used, Genesis 7, with the flood, God intervenes to destroy the world in order to eventually purify it. We see in Deuteronomy 28 that God will intervene by giving them rain, by opening the heavens and blessing the people with rain if they obey. And then we have Ezekiel. And then the next time that the heavens are open is the baptism of Jesus in Matthew 3, that we see that God is going to intervene, right? God sent his son to the earth, and he will intervene. And then the last mentioning of it is Revelation 19, when Christ comes. Christ returns after the tribulation period to conquer the world, right? Which is, again, directly intervening into human history. And so that is the point of the heavens opening. So we see that when all hope seems to be lost, God is about to intervene. And then even more so, and even more spectacular, Ezekiel then states, and I saw visions of God. I saw visions of God. The word for visions is essentially, just in more of a noun form, the same word for the previous word saw, or see, to see. So it's like, I saw seeing things. And there's a bunch of different words for vision, so why use that particular word for vision? Because, again, emphasizing the fact, Ezekiel felt so separate from God. Everything, I will not commune with God again, it's done. But then, when I thought it was all gone, all hope was lost, I physically saw God. I saw him with my own eyes. And we see that throughout Ezekiel, especially through chapter 1 and even throughout, we see verbs that are used, like, I saw, I heard, touched, or felt, all these things, all these words that are associated with presence, right? That associated with God, like with presence between people, right? If someone says, like, I heard them speaking or something, it wouldn't make sense that the person's not present with them, right? Like, no. I guess if you have a telephone or something. But that doesn't count. They didn't have that back then. So it has all these verbs, idea of presence, right? To again emphasize the theme of Ezekiel, the presence of God. That emphasizing that God is present and God will intervene. And then verses 2 through 3, like I mentioned, gives the historical introduction. Just showing, giving it its place in history, that it's in the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin. Kind of the order of some of the kings up to this point, I guess we could, I'll just review beyond him. But there is Jehoiakim, whose son is Jehoiachin. Very similar names, don't know why. But then if you've read some of, just if you know a little bit about ancient Israel's history, at this point it says that he's in exile, right? But at this point there's someone else reigning in Jerusalem. There's someone else reigning, and that's King Zedekiah, who is the brother of Jehoiakim, so Jehoiakim's uncle. And this shows that since he is the uncle, since he already started reigning, and the Bible continually shows that Jehoiachin is the true king, that he is the one that the David line, the Davidic line is going to go through, that he is not, Zedekiah is not a rightful heir to the throne. This will come into play even more so in, I think, chapter 12, that you'll see that kind of played out a little bit more. But then this is emphasized at the end of 2 Kings in chapter 25. At the end, we see that those books end with the release of Jehoiachin from imprisonment in Babylon to be seated at the king's table in Babylon to show that the Davidic line is not over. God's plan is still continuing. And so Jehoiachin is the true king, and that's why Ezekiel puts Jehoiachin here and says Zedekiah, because Ezekiel recognizes that Zedekiah is not the official king, is not the genuine king of Judah at that time. And we see, so that puts it, that's when this is taking place. And God is showing, though, even though the king of Judah, even though King Jehoiachin is in exile, the plan is continuing. The plan is still going. That just because he's in exile doesn't stop anything. But he will continue his plan. And it is all according to plan. And then, last thing to point out in verse 3, notice it says, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there, was upon Ezekiel. The hand of the Lord refers to God's strength. And do you guys remember what Ezekiel means from last week? The name itself. God is strong. Yeah, God is strong, right? And so we see that this, again, lines up perfectly with that. The hand of the Lord, God's strength, is going to be with Ezekiel. The power of God is going to be seen through Ezekiel's life and his ministry. That God will continually show through Ezekiel that God is strong. God is strong. And especially stronger than the wicked and rebellious people of Israel and Judah. And so that kind of gives us the introduction part of it. And we can move into one of the more interesting parts of the book of Ezekiel. But it's brilliant. It's good. And so, I don't know, have you guys kind of read through chapter 1 before, or maybe before this class? Hopefully some of you, most of you. And I'm sure as you're reading it, you'll see that, yeah, it's confusing. It is. But it should be. It should be. Why? There's two reasons why this can be difficult, right? Why this passage can be difficult. The first is because, and probably the more important of the two, it is the more important of the two, is that this account is one of the most extensive, most detailed accounts of the glory of God in Scripture, in especially like the Old Testament, right? We see 25 verses devoted all about God's glory. Whereas when you look at passages like Isaiah 6, there's maybe like 6 verses. When you look at stuff like Revelation 4, right? There's more description about what's around the throne rather than what the throne and what God is like himself. It's more about everything surrounding it. But we see here just a very detailed 25 verses about the glory of God. And so naturally that's going to be complicated, right? Because you're having Ezekiel, a man, a human, trying to describe something that's basically indescribable. So his words aren't going to make sense sometimes, or just be hard to understand, because he's doing his best to try to describe something that, a lot of things that simply are beyond words. And we see that that in some cases he essentially runs out of words, that he's trying so hard to describe these things that he's like, it's like this, but then it's even more like this. And he starts like trying to increase it, but then he's like exhausting the Hebrew language. He's just exhausting, running out of more like higher things to say, to the point that, as we'll talk about, he may have even invented a word. Maybe. And so that's just part of the reason why it's so difficult, right? And I think that should make sense to us, right? I don't think that a really detailed account of God's glory should come super easy to us. Or that we can come away thinking, I know everything about God. I know everything about who he is. I don't think that should be the case. But he has put in his word, and we can understand to some extent. And the second reason why this passage can be difficult, essentially, can be the culture that we live in, the American culture, in a sense, because we're a very heavy movie culture, right? We love movies. We have movie theaters all around, and movies are coming out every week, and new ones happening all the time. And so when we read passages like this, when we see sort of the images that Ezekiel starts to depict and what he starts to describe and stuff, we can kind of start turning that into the realm of movies and think, one, either that's, it's not a big deal. Like, I've seen something so much better than that. You're like, that wasn't real. But, and so you might think when you read this, okay, what's so great about this? What's so glorious about this chapter? And then the second reason is that you might think that this is all fiction, right? Because that's where movies thrive, right? That's the whole point of movies, is to enter into the realm of fiction, right? And then the cheesier movies are the ones that are closer to reality, right? When you look at movies, you're like, oh, that's so cheesy. It's like coming a mile away. And it's like, why? Because that's what happens. If that happened in real life, you'd be like, that was awesome. Like, that's great, you know? But when it happens in a movie, you're like, oh, that was stupid. That happened the other day, or, you know, like, just stuff like that. Because movies want to take you into the fantasy, into the fiction, right? That can be our danger when we approach text like this as well, that we can start to assume that this is fictional, or that it's not a big deal, one of those. And so we need to be on guard when we approach text like this. Um, And I don't know. I just think it's funny that just to give you an idea of how people have confused this passage and interpreted in a variety of ways. I was reading a while ago for this one assignment I was doing on this. This guy was arguing that this is one of the chapters that gave a defense of UFOs in the Bible. And so he went through like verse by verse, like every single phrase, showing that each part of this was actually referring to part of a UFO. He's like the furnace rounds, that's the flames of the thrusters going, and and so it's confusing, right? People get UFOs out of it somehow. So, and I don't hold to that interpretation. Someone in our class said they read someone that argued that it was a Stargate. I don't know how that works either. I kind of want to read what that was, but interesting to say the least. And so, as we come into verses 4 to 28, we begin to look at this section. In verse 4, notice, I'll make one quick observation with this. The first word, as I looked, right, or saw, or something to do with seeing, right, should be there. And quickly going back to verse 1, remember he said, I saw visions of God, right? The words received there, the same word kind of just spelled differently. The one used in verse 1 is this, don't worry about it, if you don't know Hebrew, it's okay. You'll still get this, don't be scared. Because all you have to do is count, right? All you have to do is count. First one used in verse 1 is this one. Notice there's 1, 2, 3, 4 letters. This one in verse 4, right? Verse 4 is only 3, right? May not look like letters, but they are. And there's only 3. And you're like, okay, is that really a big deal? Yes. Because what? Because what takes longer to say, right? If you're speaking, what's longer to say? The longer word, right? Yeah, longer word. This takes longer to say. If you want to say something quick, you say the shorter version. They both mean the same thing, but it's just showing that verse 1 essentially shows, like, and I beheld, I saw all these things. But then the shorter version is used the rest of the time until verse 28. So whenever you see like look or saw, it's that word being used, a shorter version. And the whole point behind this is that it's giving the idea of like quick snapshots, like all throughout. That he's like, I look, I saw this, and it's all happening really, really quick the whole time. And it's kind of like in movies when you have like those flashbacks, or you know, where like there's a bunch of scenes, like I don't know, when people's lives are flashing before their eyes, it's like boom, 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 like all these scenes of just quick snapshots, and it's happening really fast. And that's the idea of what Ezekiel is portraying in verses like 4 to 27, is this idea of quick snapshots. It's all happening so fast, boom, 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 and then I saw it all. And he uses a long version again in 28, and I saw it, and I beheld it, and I saw all these things, and then I saw my face. But, and so, even one letter can make all the difference, you see. But that is the importance of it. This is all happening so fast before Ezekiel, and he's trying his best to be recounting all these things. I'm trying to think of the right word to use there. All right. I guess the next point we could be on the approaching chariot. I don't know if I ever emphasized that. We're on the approaching chariot. Verse 4. You may be wondering why I give that title. Because this is a chariot that's being described in verses 4 to 28. It's a chariot. And so you have to keep that in mind as we go through, and I'll elaborate on that as we continue into this. But it is a chariot. It's God's chariot. And so you have to keep that in mind as we go through, because there's going to be comparisons between chariots, like human chariots, and this chariot here. But first, what does the chariot mean? Why have a chariot here? A lot of commentators will say it's to symbolize judgment, that God's about to judge and destroy Israel. That the chariot, right, is a weapon of war, and that it's going to judge. It's going to destroy everyone. And there's a hint, yeah, there's judgment involved, but biblically, looking at past biblical passages about God's chariot, is that the purpose of the chariot is more so for salvation. It's more for salvation. In Deuteronomy 33, it talks about God riding through the heavens to save Israel. Who is like you, O God, who rides among the heavens to save, right, to deliver? 2 Samuel 22 talks about, in David's, one of his psalms that he talks about the Lord riding on his cherubs in order to save, in order to save him. Psalm 104 mentions that the clouds are God's chariot, that he rides among the clouds. And this whole psalm is a whole psalm of praise, that he recognizes it as a good thing. It's not some just dreaded thing that's coming. And then even in Habakkuk 3, he mentions that the Lord comes on the chariot of salvation, that he went out for the salvation of his people. And so, the predominant reason for the chariot is salvation. But what does salvation involve? Judgment, right? Because if you're delivering someone from something, most of the time you're destroying the enemy, right? And so, like when David's delivered, it's for the destroying the enemy. But the question becomes, okay, so this will involve judgment against Israel's enemies. But what if their enemies are themselves? Which is the case. As we'll see, that a lot of this is coming up not because of outside invasions or outside pressures, it's because of their own sinfulness, their own wickedness. So essentially, they are the enemy, and therefore judgment is going to come, and God must kill the enemy, which is Israel, in order to save Israel. Sounds really weird, but it's true, that he will essentially kill Israel, and that's where in Ezekiel 37 you have the valley of dry bones, right? Why do you have a valley of dry bones? Because people are dead, right? But then he raises them from the dead. So the chariot, yes, has a hint of judgment, because that's involved in salvation, but salvation is the overarching point of what is happening here. So Ezekiel would be happy to see the chariot, not frightened or scared, because he would recognize the chariot is for salvation, not just judgment in and of itself. Now we looked at that. As I mentioned, that Ezekiel is going to be comparing this whole time human chariot and God's chariot in these verses. Human chariots are hindered by three things, and Ezekiel essentially will address all these things. But the first thing is turning radius. Human chariots don't have good turning radius. They tip over if you try to turn too sharply, right? That's why the whole stadiums, right, they're super long and they eventually curve around so that they don't just tip over all the time. They can't just pull a 360 like right away. It takes them a while, right? Second thing that hinders them is the terrain. You don't usually take a chariot riding through the woods, right? You'll hit a tree or do something. And that's why in Exodus, when Pharaoh and his men chase after Israel's in the Red Sea, that they get stuck, right? The terrain stops them, the mud clogs and everything. And so terrain can majorly hinder a chariot. And then third, wheels tend to fly off. They just are not dirty all the time. So you can come off. Those are the three things that hinder. And so keep those kind of in the back of your mind as we go through the rest of this, because Ezekiel will be comparing these things. He'll be showing how God's chariot relates to that and how it's better, how it's more glorious, how it's stronger, how it's just more efficient than all these things any human chariot can manufacture. But continuing in verse 4, we see that, "As I looked, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, and a great cloud with brightness around it, and fire flashing forth continually, and in the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal." Remember I said that Ezekiel would have felt trapped being separated from God, right? But we see this slight mentioning of this chariot comes from out of the north. You would think, so remember, Israel's down here, Ezekiel's over there. It says it came out of the north. Wouldn't you expect maybe from the south or from the west, right? You'd expect God to be coming from here, from his temple, straight to him, right? But it says from the north. Why north? Because he's coming through Babylon, through the capital, to show that he has conquered Babylon's God. It's like, where is Babylon's God? I just ran him over on my way over here. It's essentially what it is. That he's showing that my presence is not bound to Jerusalem. My presence is not bound to the temple. In fact, this God that you think, this God of Babylon, Marduk, that you think has all this power over you, I just ran him over. I just destroyed him on my way over here. And again, showing that this isn't over, right? This isn't over. And we see just like a chariot kicks up dust, right? Makes dust clouds as it's going. This chariot is also kicking up dust, except it's making a wind, right? It's a stormy wind and a great cloud with brightness around it. And fire flashing forth continually. And notice where it says, "And in the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal." Right there, gleaming metal, that word, is one of the words that only Ezekiel uses. And he uses it only three times. Here, in verse, later on in this, 27, verse 27, and I think in chapter 8. Is like the third time he uses it. And so he uses it three times only, and he's the only one who uses it. And that's the one word that he may very well have made up on the spot, because there's no other occurrence of it. People are like, what does this mean? What does he mean by this? And so what could have been happening was that during this, all this fire flashing, like, there's a great cloud with brightness around it, with fire flashing out of it. And then something brighter than fire in the midst of it, something that I have no idea what it is. And then he could have just made up something on the spot to describe it. He very well may have. Or this might be a word that just fell out, but I don't know. Modern Hebrew, the word is, they use that same word for electricity. So Ezekiel obviously did not mean that back then, right? Can't read that back in. But just this whole idea of something that's brighter, that's more glorious than the fire, than the brightness, something beyond his words, beyond his vocabulary. We'll do a second, then we'll take a break. So four living creatures. Verses 5 through 14, the next point, 3. Oh, and keeping this in mind, that all of verse 4, that's only describing the dust. That's not even the chariot yet. That's just the dust around the chariot. And Ezekiel's already at a loss for words, which is definitely saying something. But the four living creatures, verses 5 to 14. As we approach this section, we need to contrast between what Ezekiel's describing here and a horse. And a horse. Because what pulled the chariots? Horses. And so this is essentially the engine of God's chariot. And so these four living creatures are going to be compared to a horse. Let's see. Verse 5 says, "And from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had a human likeness, but each had four faces, and each of them had four wings." So in verse 5, it says it's like a human likeness, which most people would say means they probably stood upright, like humans do. But this also does not just give their posture, does not just tell about what they look like, but also tells about them that what is one of the kind of distinct characteristics of man that separates him from animals. Alright, what do you guys think? Just if you think in the context of
the thumb.
Yeah, but something else.
The face, the soul.
Soul, yeah, kind of, but I don't know, if you think about Genesis 3, what were they able to do once, I guess, they fell?
Clothes.
Kind of, but what, knowledge. Let's go with that. Knowledge, right? The capability of knowledge. That wasn't that easy, don't worry. I wasn't expecting someone, knowledge, right off the bat. That would have been amazing if someone did, but I wasn't expecting that. All those other things are true, for sure. All those things are true, for sure. But humans have the capability of knowledge, right? To know knowledge. Dogs can learn tricks, I guess, and all that stuff, but they don't really know a lot. And so basically what this is getting at is that these creatures, these angelic beings, are smart. They're intelligent. Again, contrasting with the horse. Horses, they're smart to some degree, I guess. They can jump over obstacles. They can avoid some stuff. But when something kind of terrible is coming, they, like, freak out, right? They don't know how to react, and that's why you have, like, accidents. That's why, they break rank. A lot when armies are charging, right? If you can disrupt the horses, you'll disrupt the whole army, right? Because they don't know how to react in those situations. But these creatures, these angelic beings, they're smart. They can think. They know what to do when something comes their way. So they can think and react. They're intelligent. This engine of the chariot is intelligent. And then verse 6, it talks about each one having four faces and four wings. Emphasis on four. Is to show the omnidirectional characteristic of the chariot, that it can move in any direction. Front, back, right, left, right? Because when you have something that's smart, right, you're only as smart as what? As the way you're facing, right? You're not... it's hard to be effective when you're not facing something, which is why they have four faces. They're always facing forward every way. And then their four wings allow for movement in all four directions. I don't know exactly how they were situated, because later on we'll see that two wings cover their body. But they fly. They're able to fly in every direction. Again, superior than a chariot, because what? A chariot can go pretty much forward, right? Can't even go backwards. Like, the horse would just walk into the chariot, I guess. I don't know. Like, you can't really push it backwards. Even cars today are only bidirectional. There are only two ways, forward and reverse. You can turn, right? But your wheels are turning, not your engine. And so it shows that it can move in any direction. Again, superior than any chariot man can make. We'll come back to the faces and wings in a little bit. But then verse 7 says, their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like burnished bronze. Says their legs were straight. It doesn't just mean that their legs are locked the whole time and they're walking around all awkward and stuff. But it's the idea of they're straight, not wobbly, that they're not shaky at all. That these legs are firm, they're not going to stumble, they're not going to fall, right? Like if a horse's legs become weak or something, they'll fall.
That's what horses do before earthquakes.
Really?
Really. Yeah, their fore legs are out straight. They're bracing themselves for.
There you go. I did not know that. That's awesome. So, so it gives that idea of stability, of firmness, right? But it's like that all the time, that they're firm all the time, that these won't stumble. And then this idea of burnished bronze. It's not the thrusters on some sort of UFO, as some would suggest. It's just showing that it's reflecting God's glory, that it's beautiful. It's burnished bronze has the idea of something that's like just come out. It's glowing hot, right? Just melted and stuff, and it's just glowing from the heat, and it's glorious. It's beautiful, and as we'll see, that each part of the chariot reflects God's glory, that while everything is very functional and very effective in its functions, it's also glorious. It's also brilliant and beautiful. And then verse 8 says, under the wings, on their four sides, they have human hands. So not only do they have their wings? Not only they have four faces, and then they have their feet, they had hands, human hands. This shows that that these beings are skillful, right? With hands, they are skillful. Because, again, comparing the chariot of ancient times, your whole chariot was the weapon, right? That a lot of times, the horses will lead the charge and they'll knock over people, right? They'll stomp on people. That's why, as like medieval times developed, they developed like the pikes and the stuff, not to stop men, but to stop the horses, right? And so your whole chariot was some sort of weapon. But this chariot, they have hands. They're skillful. They don't just ram people like horses. They can actually destroy people. They can actually fight and do stuff. Unlike a horse who can only ram. They are better than the horses. And then we see in verses 9 to 11 that Ezekiel comes back to the faces and the wings, essentially to show their importance, to show that they are important, they deserve a second mentioning. I guess at the end of verse 8 it says, and the four had their faces and their wings thus. Verse 9, their wings touched one another. Each one of them went straight forward without turning as they went. So their wings, like you said, touch one another. This shows that they are unified in all their movements. They don't contradict one another. One isn't trying to go right and the other is trying to go left. That they're unified. They know what's going on. They're not going to split apart in that sense. It also mentions that the creatures went straight forward without turning as they went. We mentioned that one of the hindrances of human chariots is the turning radius, right? That they struggle with turning. And this chariot solves this problem right here. It doesn't turn. Okay, how does that work? Because when it has the four faces, right, and the four wings, four faces allowing it to face all directions, the four wings allowing it to go in all directions, that you're always going forward, right, in a sense. It's weird for us to think because we don't have four faces, so we're not used to it. But this idea is that no matter which way they're going forward, And so they don't have to turn, right? They just kind of move around, right? Because their engines allow them to go whichever way. They're always going forward to some extent. And that's always like the fastest and the best way, right? Even when you're driving a car, you can't go as fast in reverse, I don't think. I don't really know cars that well, but it doesn't seem like it. My car sounds super weak when I go in reverse. But it sounds weak when I go forward too. But you're always, I guess, your strongest, right, when you're going full speed ahead. Right? And so this chariot can do that in all directions. And then in verse 11, just skipping over verse 10 for just a second, but to stay on the topic of the wings, that it shows, Ezekiel also gives not just a function ability of the wings, but also shows that it says, and their wings were spread out above. Each creature had two wings, each of which touched the wing of another, while two covered their bodies. So they're also used for covering themselves in order to cover themselves from the glory of God. That even though these creatures are so glorious, even though they're so brilliant and effective, even they have to hide themselves from the glory of God. Even they can't stand uncovered before the Lord. Even they have to hide themselves. And then going back to verse 10, we'll see the faces. As for the likeness of their faces, each had a human face. The four had the face of a lion on the right side. The four had the face of an ox on the left side, and the four had the face of an eagle. Such were the faces. And so each of these faces, these are not just random animals. They're chosen for a reason. That they're all each they all symbolize the nature of creation. I'll explain that. First, you have the human, right? The human face, who God made as the ruler, essentially, of the earth, right? In Genesis, he has dominion over all things. He is the ruler of the earth. Then you have the lion, who the common idea of it is the king of the jungle, right? And that's essentially the way they thought of it back then, too. The lion is the king of the wild animals, those who are not domesticated. And then the eagle is the king of the air, the strongest one of the air, that conquers the air, essentially. And then the ox, or some would say bull, is the king of all the domestic animals, right? Even most people don't mess with bulls, even though they're domestic animals. You don't just jump in a ring with a bull, right? Some people do. Rodeo clowns, I guess, but not all you guys are rodeo clowns. But so essentially, it's showing that this chariot contains these angelic beings, contain every kind of main aspect of creation. And you might be thinking, what about the sea? What about the creatures that live in the sea and all that? In their mindset, in that ancient mindset, and I guess it's still true today, we don't essentially rule the sea because we don't live on the sea. We live on land, right? And so in their mindset is that we don't rule the sea, right? Because we don't live there. And so that's why they are not mentioned. And I'll explain a little bit later more of the importance of that too. But verse 12, moving on. Verse 12, still on the same thing about the living creatures. And each went straight forward. Wherever the spear would go, they went without turning as they went. This gives the idea that all their movements are seamless, that they're all instantaneous. That the spirit directs them, and they move right away. If they want to stop, they stop. If they move right away, instantaneous. It's not even true of our cars, right? Like, if we want to stop, we have to take a while to slow down. We don't just stop immediately. But this chariot can do that. Verse 13, As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches moving to and fro among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. Again, just another verse showing the more glorious aspect of it. And then verse 14, and the living creatures darted to and fro like the appearance of a flash of lightning. So not only can they move in any direction, not only are they facing all ways and move fast, they're as fast as lightning. They move like a flash of lightning, that quick. So they can do it all instantaneously without contradiction at the speed of light, essentially. So, do you guys need a break, or can I just keep going? Is that cool? We don't have much time, so I want to get through chapter one. But any questions up to this point? Cool. All right, verse 15, the wheels of the chariot. The wheels of the chariot. And this section contains that famous thing of the wheel within a wheel and all that stuff, and the wheel full of eyes and all that. So we see verse 15, now as I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on earth beside the living creatures, one for each of the four of them. Which gives the idea there's four wheels, right? One for each four. As for the appearance of the wheels and their construction, their appearance was like the gleaming of beryl, and the four had the same likeness, their appearance and construction being as it were a wheel within a wheel. What does it mean, a wheel within a wheel? Some people might say it's like the rim within the wheel or something like that. But more of the idea, probably, is that it's an idea of a wheel with one wheel intersecting to create kind of a sphere. It's hard to draw, I guess, because it's not three-dimensional. But you essentially have one wheel like that and then another one intersecting through to kind of create a sphere, right? A sphere. Because why? Because the chariot, like we said, moves in all four directions. If your wheel is only one way and you try to move that way, you're just going to topple over, right? But if you have a sphere, you can move all you want. One of the best examples of this is the movie I, Robot. Have you guys seen that? I don't know if you have. If not, just you can watch that scene. I don't know. His car, he has spherical wheels that allow him to move. And it's that same idea. It's a sphere going around to allow that movement in all directions. And that's emphasized in the next verse. When they went in any of the four directions, because they had spherical wheels, without turning as they went. And their rims were tall and awesome, and the rims of all four were full of eyes all around. Full of eyes all around. Some hold that this is actual literal eyes. I tend to lean not towards that because the word used here in Hebrew for eyes is actually a word that's used all throughout this chapter, but you just don't see it because they translate it as gleaming or sparkling. It's the same word. Just without a preposition in this case. And so it seems more likely that the idea is that these wheels, these rims, are not full of literal eyes looking around, looking at you, being all creepy and stuff, but rather are, they're full of sparkling, full of sparklingness. Again, showing its beauty, right? Because some people would argue, yeah, they're literal eyes, and it represents the omniscience of God, that he sees everything, he knows everything. And the problem with that is this is part of the chariot, and so that's almost seeming to equate that the chariot, parts of the chariot have omniscience, but the chariot's not God itself. God is on the chariot. And so that doesn't seem to fit or be likely. Instead, it seems to be better to view this as kind of full of sparkling in a sense. To show its brilliant beauty. in verse 19. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures rose from the earth, the wheels rose. Whenever the spirit wanted to go, they went, and the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When those went, these went, and when those stood, these stood. And when those rose from the earth, the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. So not only, as we mentioned before, can it go in any direction and all that, and as fast as lightning, verse 19 and 20 both tell us that it can lift off the ground too. So that goes back to one of the hindrances, right? Terrain or obstacles which hinders human chariots. That's no more a hindrance, right? It's not a hindrance anymore because it can just go over it if it wants. It can lift up. This is the superior chariot to anything that humans can make. When I taught this in high school group, one of the high schoolers mentioned, he's like, it's like the Cadillac of chariots. Which, yeah, I guess. It is. It's more glorious. It's just better than any other chariot. And so, I guess, kind of to give somewhat of a picture to get what's going on. I was showing this picture before, and hope I'm replicating it right, and nowhere near close to what's going on here, but gives you an idea of what's going on. But and it stuck with me, so hopefully this will be too. So you have living creatures, right? These are the living creatures. They have a cube per head because of the four faces, right? And the reason behind it. It's just hard to draw because I drew that way too high. That's okay. Make the top smaller than it is. So four living creatures, right? They're four faces. They have a cube per head because it's four faces. And their wings kind of going out and touching each other and all that. I don't know exactly how the wings are. Did I get the same marker as I did the other time? And then they have the two covering the body. I'm not going to draw that. I don't know how to do that. Have that. And then they have the wheels next to them, right? Each one. And then next to them, I don't even know where to draw this last one. Okay. Around there. So you have these chairs. This is all kind of like flat lined. It looks like they're above them, but they're not. I can't draw in 3D. I'm sorry. But that's kind of the idea, right? You have the four faces, right? They have their wings touching one another in unison, and they have the wheels, with the intersecting wheels right next to them, the spheres kind of going. And so that's where we're at so far, is we have these. But more is to come as we keep going. Let's see. This will be the next one. Section 5, the expanse. The expanse. The verse 22. Over the heads of the living creatures, there is the likeness of an expanse, shining like awe-inspiring crystal spread out above their heads. And under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight. Actually, let's just stop at 22. Spread out above their heads. So now we have some sort of expanse. So some sort of, I don't know what it is, platform type thing that's sparkling. There you go. Sparkling. It's beautiful, right? So, have that above the creatures. The expanse. Kind of a rare word as well. It's mentioned in Genesis 1, right? In creation. God creates an expanse between heaven and earth, between the waters, right? And we see here in the chariot the mentioning of a bunch of creatures, right? We have man, humans. We have lions, we have ox, we have eagles, creatures below the expanse, right? Just like God created in the creation account, right? He separates heaven from earth with the expanse. So below the expanse is the creatures. And above, as we'll see in a little bit, is God. And so it's not just empty up there. But there is something above that. And so, essentially what this chariot becomes is two things. Microcosm, the word we used before. Those of you who weren't here, microcosm, a miniature representation of something. Just a, again, I didn't know that when I first heard it, so giving you a definition. Microcosm, miniature representation of something. So here, the chariot itself, we talked about last time that the temple was microcosm of Eden and the whole idea of God's presence being there and stuff. And so essentially this chariot becomes a microcosm of two things. First, the world, right? As I was just hinting at with that, right, with the expanse. And even, as I was mentioning before, all the different creatures, right, involved, how that's representative, essentially, of all the nature of creation, in a sense. And so, it's a microcosm of the world, based on its structure, right? Based on its structure, right? With the expanse in between the top and the creatures on the bottom. And the purpose is to show that God rules over creation. God rules over creation. Because as we'll see, kind of spoil it, I don't know, that God is above the expanse that we'll see in the coming verses. But then the second thing that the chariot also is essentially a microcosm of the temple. Based on, one, God's presence, and its structure as well. But just as God's presence was seen in the temple, was seen all throughout the temple, now the chariot is shown that, right? Because within the temple you had the Ark of the Covenant, which was often referred to as, or in reference to the Ark of the Covenant, you had God called the one enthroned above the cherubim. The one enthroned above the cherubim. And we'll see here that, again, I guess spoiling it, I don't know. There's a throne on top of that with a man sitting on it. Again, above cherubim, above angelic beings. So essentially it becomes both God's presence in it, a microcosm of the world and the temple. That makes sense, hopefully. And we see that even this expanse shows God's glory in that it is so brilliant, it is so bright, that Ezekiel can't even look at it for very long. We see this in verse 23 because it says, and under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight, one toward another. That because Ezekiel starts kind of the bottom working his way up, right? He starts with the creatures and the wings and kind of working his way up. He moves up to the expanse, but then now he's going back down. Essentially because it was so bright that he couldn't keep looking at it. It's like, so bright, I have to go back down to what I was just looking at instead. And so he goes back down to the living creatures underneath. And this just emphasizes even further how glorious this expanse is. It says, and under the expanse their wings, the wings of the living creatures, were stretched out straight one toward another. And each creature had two wings covering its body. That they're stretched out straight one toward another. Essentially creating a covering, kind of like an umbrella. Can't really see it on my picture, but kind of creating an umbrella effect, protecting them from God's glory, that they can't even allow any of that glory to come through. It is just too bright, even for them. Even for them. And then verse 24, and the sound of these living creatures, the wings moving, it says, I heard the sound of the rings, like the sound of many waters, like the sound of the Almighty, the sound of tumult, like the sound of an army. And so we see that even their wings, the movement of their wings are so loud that they are as loud as anything naturally or supernaturally can be. Naturally, the sound of many waters, it's not like it's trickling the water or something like that. It's like waterfalls. If you've been near a waterfall, you know how deafening loud they can be. And so it's that idea that something that loud and that just deafening of a sound. And then even on the supernatural aspect, the sound of the Almighty, that God's voice himself, that sound, it's just as loud. It's interesting that the next verse that that God's voice is even greater than somehow this voice, this sound. Because as soon as it says when they stood still, they let down their wings, and so it became silent. And then we hear, and there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads. When they stood still, they let down their wings. And so everyone is sitting there thinking that, okay, these wings, it's so intense, it's so loud, that it's just louder than anything that we can even think of. But then suddenly, when they stop, then the real noise comes. That, I guess if you could say verse 24, if that's kind of showing the loudest noise within creation that can exist or something, verse 25 shows the loudest noise that can exist, period, of all. And it's interesting that Ezekiel doesn't even describe this voice, right? And that's not characteristic of him. He describes everything, right? He just describes the other sound, serving at the waters, to the voice of the Almighty, to the army, sound of an army, all these things. He's describing in detail all these things, and then he comes to this voice, and nothing. Doesn't say anything about it. It's just silent. And what it seems, and probably the case, is he can't describe it. He's like, it's just one of those things, like, what was it like? Loud? Like, you know, like, it's louder than all those things. Yeah, you can't even describe it. That's how loud it is. But, and it's so loud that it draws Ezekiel's attention, that he no longer dwells upon the expanse. He doesn't even stop there. He just continues right on past that to look above the expanse and to see what is over that and to see what is sitting upon the expanse. And that's where we come to the king, section 6, the king, verses 26 to 28. We see, and above the expanse over their heads was the likeness of a throne, an appearance like sapphire. And so, let me stop there for now. Sapphire is one of the most precious stones at that time. Again, hinting at how glorious and how brilliant this chariot is. And so, and it says, notice the likeness of a throne, that it was like a throne, which means that it's not exactly a throne, right? Well, then, what is it? Because normally, thrones, what do they symbolize? Like kingship, rulership, authority, all these things. And, well, God, doesn't he possess all those things? Yes, he does. But they're not like ours. His authority, his throne, his rulership, all those things are not like ours. And it's not the fact that God is imitating us. Because normally when we use something like that, right, we say, I'm like Ryan. It means that I'm kind of seeking to imitate him, right? But the reverse is happening, that he is like, that the throne is like, it's a likeness of a throne, it's like a throne, not because God is trying to imitate us or trying to imitate our thrones, but it's because our thrones are not like his throne. That ours are the one doing the imitating, and we fail. And we see that God alone is the one who has authority. He has what it truly means to be sovereign and truly, and what it truly means to be king. And everyone else is just a variation of off of him or of him. And that's the idea behind Romans 13, right? That God has the authority to appoint rulers of this world, the authorities in this world, because he is the only one with ultimate authority. All authority on this earth is like his. And so now in our experience we have probably a lot bigger than me, but it's shared. But so we see the likeness of a throne, right? Maybe it's dotted because not like ours. Just to get that point across. And then the same thing we see, and it says, continuing on in verse 26, and seated above the likeness of a throne was a likeness with a human appearance. So that same idea. Now there's a likeness of a man sitting on the throne. And it's not that because what? We're made in the image of God, right? So we're like God. Which means that he's also like us to an extent, but he's not. Because we're trying to imitate him, but we do so imperfectly, right? Like God is like us to that extent, but we are seeking to actually imitate him. He's not imitating us. But we do so imperfectly. And so that kind of comparative particle, that comparative idea just works backwards. The reverse of it. So now we have a man. I would take a roller coaster or something. I don't know. But Casey drew a better picture. Looks so much better than mine. I don't know if you can see it. Looks so much cooler than mine. But so you can look at it after if you want. A lot better than mine. I don't know. But yeah. So he's like a man in that sense. And then we see as we go forward, and upward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, gleaming metal. Remember the gleaming metal from verse 4? Now we see what the source of that gleaming metal was. That before in verse 4, as he's seeing the chariot approach, as he's just seeing the dust cloud, and he sees in the midst of it some sort of brightness that he can't even describe. It's like gleaming metal, something. I don't know, now he knows what it is. It's God. It's the one seated on the throne. That is the source of this gleaming metal, this brilliance. It says, like the appearance of fire enclosed all around, and downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire, and there was brightness around him. Like the appearance of the bow that is on the cloud on the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness all around. The appearance of the bow. Some might say rainbow or something like that, rainbow or bow in verse 28. But what kind of Bible story does that make you picture right away? Flood, right? Noah. Yeah. Noah and the flood, right? That when God was, after he had flooded the earth, he puts the rainbow, the bow in the sky to symbolize that I will not destroy the earth like that again. And this is the same word for like a bow and arrow, like an actual bow and arrow used in scripture. And so this idea, basically what God is saying with Noah's flood is that I'm putting my weapon on the rack. I'm putting my weapon away. But what's the problem now? Is that the bow's not in the sky anymore, where it's with him, that he has the bow now. The weapon is no longer on the rack. It's in his handling, I guess you could say, which means that arrows are going to fly. Judgment is coming, right? That whole idea. And arrows are going to fly. Just like in a chariot, that most chariot riders would have bows and arrows, not swords. They would have swords probably, but most of them would use bows and arrows. Same too with this. But not only is the bow a symbol of the judgment to come, but it's also, again, showing the brilliance and the glory of God. just as the bow shows all the colors, the radiance of colors going out, so does this bow, showing the brilliance all around it. And after seeing all these things, it says, such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, the same, I erased it, the same four-letter word used in verse 1, same idea, once I saw it, once I beheld all these things, kind of slowed down, once I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of the one speaking. And that's the voice of the one that was speaking in 25, the one that came from above the expanse. And so, and that's the end of chapter 1, and the end of our time. So, thank you guys for coming. That was a lot of information, but hopefully it made sense. If you have questions, feel free to ask or email me, whatever you want, so, and I'll do my best to answer. So. See you guys next week.
Verse 25, why didn't Jesus say, yeah, this is a louder sound?
I don't know.
I don't know how you got that.
Oh, that it was louder? Basically, probably spoke that.
It kind of amazing is that you can try this.
I will thank you for the great balance. I feel like